This is Progressive Radio, a weekly conversation hosted by Matthew Rothschild, editor of The Progressive Magazine, a leading voice for peace and social justice. For more information about Progressive Radio or The Progressive Magazine, log on to our website at progressive.org.
I'm Matt Rothschild, and welcome to Progressive Radio. Today we're going to be talking about a scarce resource, but a renewable one, and that is hope. With me to talk about it today is Paul Loeb, the editor of a new book called The Impossible Will Take a Little While, A Citizen's Guide to Hope in a Time of Fear. Paul Loeb, welcome to Progressive Radio.
Hey, very glad to be here.
It's terrific to see you. Why'd you decide to do this book?
Well, I was traveling around the country. This is right after the first, I guess, the first phase of the Iraq War, as opposed to the Abu Ghraib phase, or this is the mission accomplished phase. And everyone would oppose it. It was just so bleak and so despairing. And like, we worked, we tried, it all failed, none of it mattered. And I was saying, well, no, it does matter, even if you didn't necessarily win this round. And I wanted to give people a resource for hope. And actually, I'd actually started the idea of this book about 15 years before, during the Bush senior years, and then put it aside when things seemed to get a little bit better politically, wrote Soul of a Citizen in the meantime, and then came back to it and thought, boy, do people need hope, and what do I do? I could write it myself. I've done four earlier ones directly, but I thought this time I'll weave my own voice with a kind of a global chorus of people who've kept me going. Howard Zinn, Alice Walker, Mandela, Desmond Tutu, and just pull together these people who inspire me.
You know, it is a wonderful course, and I just wanted to rattle off some of the names that are in here. This is Paul Loeb's book, The Impossible Will Take a Little While. You know, some of the more famous ones to me, Sherman Alexie, Maya Angelou, Ariel Dorfman, Marion Wright Edelman, Martina Spada, great poet, Vaclav Havel, Jim Hightower, Martin Luther King, Jonathan Kozol, Tony Kushner, John Lewis, Mandela, you mentioned, Pablo Neruda, Marge Piercy, Adrian Rich, Aaron Dati Roy, Desmond Tutu, Alice Walker, you mentioned, Jim Wallace, Terry Tempest Williams, and of course, Howard Zinn, who's kind of the apostle of hope. But how did you get permission for all these people?
Well, a lot of them I knew from my earlier books. I look at the people who gave quotes on the previous one. There's a fair overlap with the people who wrote essays. And so I just contacted them, and sometimes they wrote, I mean, Marion Wright Edelman wrote a wonderful essay from scratch. Howard sent me two different pieces and said, maybe these two can get woven together. And I came up with parts of a third, and then we suggested some pieces to update. I stitched together two pieces of Alice Walker's from 20 years apart, and with great trepidation said to her assistant, who I'd known from before, what do you think? Do you think this will be okay with Alice? And she said, oh, it works great. So there was a kind of mix and found and stitched together and collaged, and the goal was always what will inspire people. And then there was a whole other tier where there are some people in the book who nobody has ever heard of, and there's some equally, I find some of the equally powerful essays. And I have this big 10,000 name email list. There's actually a website, theimpossible.org, where people can sign up, and once a month I send out articles. And I just broadcast to my whole email list, and I said, here's the book I'm doing. Here's who's in it so far. Are there essays that inspire you? And I got some names, some people who would be very logical. Like, I was literally composing a letter to Ariel Dorfman, and a package arrives at my door, and there's this wonderful memoir of the Allende years that he says, you know, I think this chapter might work well for your book. I heard about it from a friend. And so there's a kind of, you know, confluence and serendipity. And then some pieces just came in completely cold from wonderful unknown folks. And they're right in there in the mix with the Nobel Prize winners and all the rest of it.
It's a very inspiring book. At the same time, it's not trite. It's not I'm reviewing it for The Progressive. I say it's not fortune cookie or Hallmark, you know, ideas of hope. What do you tell, for instance, that Minnesota activist who was so despondent after participating in the greatest anti-war rally of all time on February 5th, 2003, when 10 million people were out in the streets in dozens, maybe hundreds of cities around the world, and then the war went on. You said you still need to have hope. What argument do you make to him?
I tell a couple of things. I mean, one is to say, recognize that merely by bringing this many people into involvement, something profound is occurring, because we don't know where those people are going to go on to do. And we don't know which one of them is going to become the next Rosa Parks or Havel or Mandela, because everyone gets their start at some point. And so that's an important lesson. I tell them that we don't know how history is going to turn.
But that first one is almost a great man theory, you know.
Well, it's not even a great man theory. What it really is a kind of, I call it the chain of of influence theory. So I look at the Rosa Parks story, and this is an essay that of mine, and I look at how the image of the CNN version is out of nowhere, Rosa Parks steps out of history and accidentally takes a stand on the bus and invents the civil rights movement, and all nonsense. She'd been a civil rights activist for 12 years with the NAACP. She was a secretary. You hardly have the network news cameras saying Rosa Parks is making history. She's taking minutes at a meeting, but still, you know, that's part of what builds social movements. She trained at Highlander Center.
Yeah, I mean, that was the amazing thing, Paul. I mean, you hear this ridiculous cliff notes to Rosa Parks.
Cliff notes.
Yeah, she just, you know, she's tired, and she's a lady who's tired on the bus. And right. But she went to Highlander Center, which was a very left-wing activist organization that showed people how to do social action. And out of that, and out of the NAACP local chapter, came Rosa Parks.
Right, exactly.
Like she got
and a whole community of people who are working along with us. And so part of the challenge is you read back in the fact that we act in community, that we act intentionally, although there's always a leap of faith. Jim Wallace of Sojourners has a wonderful essay, and he uses the phrases, hope is believing in spite of the evidence and then watching the evidence change. And so it's a combination of intentionality, strategic action, and at the same time, there's that leap of faith that says, you don't know how an action is going to play out in the world, but you take it again. And sometimes, as Howard Zinn writes, history surprises and it turns, and it always turns on human courage.
And you also have this beautiful poem. You've got a lot of poetry here, and I love poetry, but you have this opening poem from Seamus Heaney who says, but then once in a lifetime, the longed for tidal wave of justice can rise up and hope and history rhyme.
Yeah, I've always loved that poem. I was just waiting for an excuse to use it. And it's like, this is those moments, and you don't know when they're coming. But suddenly, one day, you know, you're there and you've worked and you've worked and you've worked. You know, and that's why it's so important to recognize Parks was there for 12 years. Suddenly something leaps. And that's what changes history visibly. But it's underpinned by everything else that led up to it.
And the poetry that you use, I believe, was intentional, or I read it as intentional. You have little poems at the beginning, I believe, of almost every chapter.
Every section.
Right.
That's right.
And to me, it suggests that there's more to life than just politics. And the thing that echoes that in the book is a great line by Howard Zinn in his chapter that you have, where he's teaching a course on politics that I imagine got pretty heavy at some point.
Yes.
And he said at the last class, he said, you know, politics can get a little sour. Political discussion can get sour sometimes. We have in this class three gifted musicians, and he just let them play classical music for the last class. That was it.
That was it.
That's just a wonderful epiphany that, you know, there's more out there than just being on the picket line as important as being on the picket line.
Well, I think that's – it's a critical lesson, is that you've got to be able to savor that journey. And I actually opened The Impossible to Take a Little While with a story about Desmond Tutu. And it's a Los Angeles benefit for a South African project. And he's been battling prostate cancer, so he's tired. He lies down for a nap. He gets up and gives his talk. Some other people speak. And a band from East Los Angeles starts playing. People start dancing. I look over. There is Desmond Tutu right in the middle of the dance floor. And I'm thinking, I have never seen a Nobel Peace Prize winner dance before, much less an archbishop. This is really interesting. And the lesson is, this is somebody who just savors the gifts of the world. And it's inseparable from that radical prophetic voice that continues to speak out against injustice, is that he just thinks that the world is a delightful place to be, even though, as much as anyone on the planet, he's certainly aware of human evil and our potential for destructiveness.
I know. I think a lot of people on the progressive side feel that you have to be almost monomaniacal on our side, and that to do anything else is to be frivolous. This is maybe the Ralph Nader example taken to the caricature degree, but he is that way sometimes. And, you know, Noam Chomsky can appear that way to people. Amy Goodman, who I know has more sides to her than that, but she is so driven and seems like she's just on this mission that people think, wow, I've got to be that way. And that is a very difficult way to be. I can't be that way.
Yeah, because what it says is, if you just tell people a little bit more of the bad news, then they'll act. And I don't think that that's how people act. I think that on some level, a great many citizens are aware of the bad news, or at least of some facets of it. Obviously, there's, you know, WMD denial and the rest of it. But still, they're aware that something's fundamentally awry, and they don't feel they can do anything about it. And so it's that powerlessness that just drives them into silence. And then they become subject of all the manipulations.
And also it's a need to understand that there's more to life than just politics.
Yeah.
And you have that in here as well. You have Wendell Berry's beautiful poem about nature. When things seem to be going to hell, though that's not the exact
right.
line.
But he goes out in the wild places and where the cat. I mean, I'm not quoting it quite right either, but the duck and the raven, and they don't right. concern themselves.
And he has a similar poem that you yeah. didn't include, but it is right along the same line, which is it's a famous anti-Vietnam War poem where, you know, the bombs are falling and he goes out into his garden and plants some seeds. And to me, I don't know. I just look at myself and, you know, I've been doing politics for 25 years, right. and I couldn't sustain it. I would have burnt out. And I think burnout is a real problem we need to address.
It's serious because we get a revolving door of activists. I mean, we get people coming into these movements, dedicated, idealistic, creative, and then because they either drive themselves past that point of exhaustion and keep on, and you can do that for a week or even a month, but you do that too long, you're gone. Or because they don't see over the horizon, they end up just feeling ground down, and then they're gone, and their voices are silenced. And part of, I mean, you know, if there's one purpose of the impossible, it'll take a little while, is to give a tool for all those people who've just stuck their toes into the water for the first time to keep on going, because if, in fact, if they do, we have this very powerful force for justice. I mean, it was going back to that, you know, that earlier lesson about broadening the movements. The Vlachov Havel piece, he talks about at one point they were circulating a petition to free some political prisoners, and they're getting mocked. And even Milan Kundera, the best-known literary figure in Czechoslovakia, refuses to sign the petition, taunts him almost, saying it's exhibitionistic and indulgent. And Havel, looking back a dozen years later, he says, you know, we didn't succeed in freeing any of those prisoners. So on some level, the critics were right. Maybe you could say we failed. He said, but we actually succeeded in a lot of ways. When those people got out of jail, they said that our solidarity, our efforts, kept them going. And all those people who signed the petition, they didn't stop there. They went on to play dissident music, preach dissident sermons, teach differently in the classroom. And that is, he was writing this in 86, he said, that will be a force that will bring down this dictatorship, which it did. And so that expansion of the base itself is a cause for, I guess I'd call for hope.
Mm-hmm. I'm Matt Rothschild. You're listening to Progressive Radio. I'm speaking with Paul Loeb, the editor of a really inspiring new book called The Impossible Will Take a Little While, A Citizen's Guide to Hope in a Time of Fear. One thing that you point out, and I know Howard Zinn does as well, that we shouldn't, I think, as you put it, look through too narrow a lens
yes.
at history, because sometimes there is what the great short story writer Junot Diaz told me once on this show, that there's the tyranny of the present,
yes.
that we think that things are the worst they've ever been because they're bad for us and we haven't experienced in our own life how things were before. And in fact, there have been advances in history. We don't have slavery. We don't have Jim Crow. Women can vote. You know, there are great advances that have happened even in our lifetimes.
Right. And hard won by citizen courage.
Yeah, that did not come, you know, either directly from on high, certainly, or because of some elected official all of a sudden saw the light, but that person was pushed by a movement of people. And we need to keep that in mind. And I think this is a reminder you have in your book as well, with Zinn and with other people. Why do you think it is so hard for us sometimes to wrap ourselves around the progress that's been made? Do you think there's some psychological crutch that we sometimes rely on in wallowing, to mix the metaphor,
in
our own despair?
I think there's some way that it confirms our virtue. I mean, that you know, it's comforting. You know, we are just the persecuted. We are the forlorn. And you know, at a certain point, you have to say that's not the task of a radical activist to sit around moping. The task is to say, you know, in a given situation, what possibilities are available, and then to try them. And one may work and one may not. And you may do something that seemingly fails and sows fruits later on. I mean, going back to Rosa Parks, I asked the question of who got her involved. And we know it's her husband. Raymond Parks was an NAACP activist before her. I don't know who got Raymond Parks involved, but somebody in a movement that didn't seem to be going anywhere got Raymond Parks involved. He later gets his wife to be involved. And then a dozen years later, not just because of her, but a whole community, a leap happens that we've all heard of.
I mean, that moping does get old, and it's so defeatist, too, because then it's a self-fulfilling prophecy.
Yeah.
And one of the great things about this book, Paul Loewe, the book, The Impossible Will Take a Little While, is you have a chapter here by a woman who I'd never heard of before, who is actually physically paralyzed. And her name, if I pronounce it correctly, Danusha Veronica Goska.
Got it right. Yes, yes.
Goska.
Yes.
And I love the part where she expresses rage for people who are metaphorically claiming to be paralyzed, because she herself was working through this paralysis and she didn't like the way that they were using it metaphorically, because she was suffering it really. And she was saying to everybody, look, you've got more power than you think.
Exactly. And this is one of the ones that came in completely unsolicited, and just, you know, she was on my email list and boom, it came in. And it's, she was, somebody was saying, I feel so paralyzed. And she's saying, well, excuse me, sometimes I am. And yet even when I am, there are things I can do. And that sense, she says, you know, that the power that we have, we give it away. We don't act on it in a way that furthers it. We almost like that position to say, It's off our shoulders because there's nothing we can do. There's actually another piece by a guy named Casey Golden, works on global climate change, where he says, you know, once you say something's inevitable, it makes it real easy. You know, you're off the hook.
Yeah, it's
you
like, know? Like the person who says, you know, we can't stop global warming tomorrow, so why recycle cans
today? Why recycle cans? It's only when you have a sense that says this is a contingent world and a contingent future that, in fact, you can create history and recognize that we're in some ways shaping history every day.
And by contingent, you mean?
Contingent on our actions.
That the course isn't inevitable.
That it's not inevitable. I mean, that what ordinary citizens do is going to determine what kind of world there's going to be 10, 20, 50 years from now. And that was true in the past. We, you know, as you said, we've inherited many of the fruits of the labors of activists previous. And it's also true now. And even if it's a hard – I mean, we can acknowledge that this is a very hard political time, because it is.
And right after the election of Bush in 2004, I mean, people were horribly despondent.
Yeah. People were just devastated. I mean, it was – I mean, I was getting – I still get them. I get emails saying literally – thank you for The Impossible Will Take a Little While. You've stopped me from jumping off a bridge. Now, maybe it's a little bit exaggerated, but I know that feeling because, heck, I mean, a little part of me is there too.
Well, what did you do on November 3rd then to regather yourself?
What did I do? I went out for a run. I thought, you know,
I think exercise is important. It may not be in this book as much as it should
be. That's
right.
I happen to live near water in Puget Sound in Washington State. It's beautiful. I went out for a long run, just looked at the water and said, you know, Bush is there, but this is all still there too. There is something larger than that. And then the Howard Zinn movie, by nice coincidence, happened to be playing in Seattle. So I've known Howard for years and went to see it with my wife. And I felt better. And so what was it about? It was, you know, recharging myself, recognizing that there's something larger, recognizing that there's a community of people who act. And then the interesting thing was, is I had a talk scheduled 3 days, starting 3 days after the election in like Kentucky, upstate Pennsylvania, and upstate New York. So all kind of red areas. And I didn't, even though I'd done those things were good, I didn't want to leave. I still wanted to go under the covers for at least 2 weeks. And I thought, like, you know, why do I have to be the guy who's got to talk about hope in this
time?
What
were the crowds like there?
The crowds were huge. And what was so interesting is people came up afterwards and said, thank you, thank you, thank you. This is so helpful. This pulls us up out of the morass. And then I felt a lot better because I felt like, well, maybe I can't change everything. Like many people, I did my best to get Bush out of there and came up a little short. But at least I can do something that's useful. And there's actually a Marge Piercy poem of, you know, about doing useful work. And when you do useful work that has a chance of moving things forward, you feel a whole lot better than simply wallowing in the despair. Mm-hmm. And so I actually felt that in my own process of what happened to me right after the election.
You're listening to Paul Loewe, who is the editor of The Impossible Will Take a Little While. And the website is theimpossible.org. It's a wonderful, inspiring book that I recommend to everybody. I'm Matt Rothschild. You're listening to Progressive Radio. To what extent do you think a religious faith is, if not a requirement, a help to people who are seeking out hope in bad times?
Well, I think it can be a tremendous consolation because it it can give you a sense that there's some kind of fundamental order to the world that is right, or in the phrase of King, the arc of the universe is long, but it bends towards justice, you know, which doesn't mean that God's going to somehow step out of the skies and, you know, kick George Bush out of office. Would that that would be true, but it doesn't work that way. But there's this sense of some kind of force to support people. And then I think for those of us who are more secular,
as I am,
you have to still have some sense of something larger. I mean, that's what you know, when I went out on that run and looked out at the water and the mountains and the trees, that there is something that, you know, was there before us, is going to be there after us. It outlasts us. And so I feel connected to the natural world, to that stream of people working for justice. The African-American historian and theologian Vincent Harding has a great phrase. There is a river, and he's talking his work on the civil rights movement, and he goes back to the biblical prophets and just traces this, the river of everybody working for justice. And all of us can feel part of that river. And part of the challenge is if we can expand the bounds of that river, then in fact we have more power and to be able to act.
So secularists can, like me, can say there are things bigger than I am without saying it's a spiritual kind of supernatural thing that's bigger than
right,
we
are. Right,
right. There's people in a movement from the beginning of this country and even before that who are moving in a liberatory direction.
And you feel connected to them. I mean, you feel part of them, and I can draw strength of – I mean, I was recently in Indiana and Terre Haute and visited Eugene Debs' house. And you know, you just – it's like Debs has been one of my heroes for decades. And it's the great socialist leader. And there you saw his house and some writings and correspondence. And I felt connected to that stream.
Say, do you think secularists like me or leaving me aside disrespect religion too much?
Yes.
Those on our side who
absolutely
are religious.
Yeah, and it's a very damaging. It's a damaging heritage of the left, you know, particularly say post World War II. I think pre World War II happened much less. And there was a sense, I mean, there were the radical priests and they were marching alongside and
maybe it's post-civil rights movement too, because there you had Abraham Joshua Heschel. Walking with Martin Luther King and
you got Sloan Coffin during, you know, not just during Vietnam. I mean, there's a, you know, very solid, I mean, we have to recognize, you know, the Iraq War. Every major denomination in the United States except the Southern Baptists came out against that war, which was something that didn't happen during Vietnam.
Or the Catholic Church and America wars in the 80s.
Right, and the Catholic Church in the Central America wars. So I think it's probably gotten better in recent years, but there's still this sort of knee-jerk, oh, this is ridiculous superstition, as opposed to these are different metaphors to, in some sense, explain the unexplainable. And so I see, and in fact, in the introduction to The Impossible will take a little while, I just said very explicitly, because I've had people say with my earlier book, Soul of a Citizen, I love the book, but why do you have those religious people in there? Or people from a religious perspective, you know, I love the book, but these people aren't talking about God. There's something missing. And to me, I mean, I guess I say that my theology is social justice. And if there's somebody who's working for a more just world, I respect the metaphors they use to drive them forward, because, you know, how can you look at a Desmond Tutu and not say, you know, that there's just profound learning that you can have from a person like that, who's very rooted in a religious tradition.
Mm-hmm. One other thing that I like about this book, Paul Loeb, The Impossible Will Take a Little While, is the frankness, I mean, the honesty about some of the obstacles that we're up against. And the line that I loved the most in that vein was by Kenneth Roth of Human Rights Watch, who just said, and I don't have the quote in front of me, but said basically, working for a human rights organization, I've got to admit, it's not a laugh a minute.
That's right, yes. And he's the executive director of Human Rights Watch, and it's like, let's recognize that things are not always wonderful, and they're not necessarily wonderful right now. And I mean, I worked so hard in The Impossible Will Take a Little While to avoid sentimentality, because it just leads you to a kind of false consolation, a false trap. And reality is, I don't know that things are going to turn out right. I mean, you know, you look at the clowns in power these days, and they're perfectly capable of annihilating practically every human achievement of the last 2,000 years. But it's also possible that we'll stop them, and it's also possible that in response to their arrogance, that we will have citizens' movements emerge that push us much forward to justice. I mean, go back to Parks. I mean, the first issue she was involved in were those around lynching. I mean, a horribly dark chapter in our country's history. And yet out of the courageous responses to that came the civil rights movement pushing things forward.
I think there is that sense of frozenness, though, of this static period we're in here, especially once Bush won. And somehow people have to realize, and I have to remind myself too in the gloomiest moments,
yes,
that there is a, you know, for every reaction, there's an equal and opposite reaction, or a dialectic, to use that old big Marxist term that I never really liked too much. But there are responses.
There are responses, and in those responses, I think we can articulate principles. I mean, I'm, you know, as the battles continue over taxes and Social Security and everything else, I talk about the Enronization of everything, because that's really what they're trying to do. It's just, you know, put everything, and Michael Harrington called it the casino economy. Same notion, except with Enron, the casino was completely rigged in the House's favor. And when we're articulating and laying out those principles, part of what we're doing is saying, all right, here's where we don't want to go, but maybe here's where we do want to go, like joining the rest of the industrial world and actually having, dare we say, something that seems impossible, healthcare for everybody.
What are some of the rays of hope that you see as you travel around?
Well, I see the convergence of the labor and environmental movement, I think, is extraordinarily important. I mean, they were historically separate. They were often antagonistic, and over the last decade, and you know, more and more so, they are trying to work together. I mean, the WTO was obviously a major point of confluence, the steelworkers uniting with environmental groups around Maxim a few years before that, and the fact that they're just meeting regularly, the top leaders, and trying to say you need a planet with habitability and you need dignity at work and solidarity, and you can't play one against the other. So I find that a hopeful sign. I find the, you know, I've mentioned earlier, you know, I don't know how many people came in to involvement in the last few years around the war and then Bush's campaign. I'm going to guess 4 or 5 million did something, wrote a letter, marched, knocked on a door, signed somebody up to vote, whatever it was. That's very hopeful. If they can stick, it is the largest movement for justice that we've got. And the sticking is not inevitable. It's depending on our giving them the framework. But if they do stick around, it's huge. I mean, I was getting letters and emails from just the tiniest cities in the country talking about what was going on in their community in places that never had anything during Vietnam. And so that's hopeful. The global solidarity is very important. I mean, Desmond Tutu pointed out, I mean, after all the bidding and bribing war to get every country involved supporting the U.S., we ended up with, well, I call it the coalition of, every time I heard the phrase, the coalition forces, I thought of us, Britain, and the child with their imaginary friends. You know, it's like, what, 100 people from Poland or something like that. That's not a coalition. And that was because of the courage of people speaking out globally. And we can draw strength from that as well.
And there's more activism on a range of issues that we didn't see before, too. I mean, I think the liberal progressive left, that whole continuum was more united than ever. But media activism just sprung up out of nowhere the last 5 years. And then this great group out of Northampton, Massachusetts, that's done Bill of Rights defense committees that have now been sprouting up in 350 cities and towns around the country, saying that their locale will not play ball with Ashcroft and now Gonzalez's Justice Department when they come trying to enforce unconstitutional aspects of the Patriot Act. I mean, that is an incredible little rebellion that's going on.
And it also does some of what's necessary, which is bridging across political lines. I mean, that some of those people who consider themselves conservatives, we're going to have to reach out and we're going to say, you know, this is the least conservative administration in decades. And they are trampling on things which all of us ought to hold, whatever our opinions on taxes or abortion or whatever, and being able to sort of get people to say, all right, we may not agree on everything, but we can find some common ground. And that means articulating, again, some fundamental principles of justice, some fundamental principles of democracy, and challenge. I mean, I have a friend who served in the Nixon administration, hired G. Gordon Liddy, and went to jail for Watergate. And he said, you know, we nearly destroyed democracy. This administration is more ruthless than we were. And I think that when you look at that squarely, he still calls himself a moderate Republican, that a lot of people who don't necessarily come out of a progressive background, we may find common ground.
And the common ground, I think you're right, is on really basic things, freedom, democracy. Yes. Paul Loeb, thanks for being my guest today.
My pleasure.
The book again, The Impossible, will take a little while. The website, theimpossible.org.
Today's program is available online at progressive.org. You can also write to us at 409 East Main Street, Madison, Wisconsin, 53703. Our music is by Mufa. Progressive Radio is produced by Elizabeth DiNovella and engineered at Audio for the Arts in Madison, Wisconsin.